question smestions.
I lord that jingle. Okay.
Just for the Vanguard Easters. We know you love it. Right, first up from Benjamin in Blackheath. Chaps, a couple of weeks back, very specific, 12th of July at 9 minutes 38 seconds, to be precise, you, as in, I'm guessing this is Mark and Simon, both casually agreed with the claim that the origins of the playground singing game Ring a Ring of Roses lie in the Great Plague. It is not true, or rather, almost certainly not true. Most folklore scholars now regard the plague explanation as baseless. To comply with your request for concision, I won't go into further details, except to say, look it up. Benjamin in Blackheath, thank you for clearing that one up. This is an interesting one. This is Anaya in Dorset. If I like a film and want something similar, what do I look at? And who do I look at? Do I go for something by the same writer and director, best boy? I know there are apps like Just Watch for if you like this, you'll like this. But what actually shapes the feel of a film? Or is it alchemy that won't be replicated and I should go by the app suggestion? I mean, this is a big question, but one I'm happy to tackle. Anaya in Dorset. Robbie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think don't please go by app suggestions, no, because that way lies the emotional heat death of all human thought. I think, I'm going to say this, but here's what I think you should do, okay? Read some film criticism. And if you like a film, read what some critics thought of it. And if anything that they say strikes a chord, either because you agree or you really don't, you know, keep up with their work and see what they think of other stuff. And they will direct you towards stuff. Once you kind of triangulate someone else's taste, you can then bounce off that. I mean, I think if you want to just go directly to IMDb credits-wise, it's got to be directors. It's a flawed system, but I think auteur theory is probably the best means cinema has of categorizing its output, probably. Even though you have, we mentioned Arthur Freed previously, or Jerry Bruckheimer, in fact, from Top Gun. Yeah. You know, these guys can be just as influential over style and tone and theme as can directors. But I think the director system probably works best. Do you agree?
I like the fact that it is also flawed. I think that's one of the enjoyable things about it. And, you know, one of the phrases I kind of live by is that William Goldman one, which is, in Hollywood, no one knows anything. In other words, you can kind of put together the ultimate list of director and writer and actors, and on paper this should be the greatest film ever made, and it doesn't turn out to be, because there is something about that alchemy, there is something about chance and luck in there as well, and that to me makes it all the more exciting, in that you can't just boil it down to an algorithm. I mean, I get algorithms a lot on music, when I listen to music, and it will really be like if I'm listening to George Michael, it will say, if you like George Michael, why not listen to Wham? And you think, really? That's the best you can come up with? The guy's previous band? So I think that those algorithms really oversimplify things. And for me, part of the joy is that the mystery really is that, yes, look at a director and maybe 90% of that director's other films will be as good as the first one you watch, but there'll also be some turkeys in there. And I just love the fact that you can never quite predict, because in Hollywood, no one knows anything. Right, next up, this is from, let me just check. Oh, this is from Chris. I've just started to learn Spanish, and to help, I've started to watch Spanish films. And it occurred to me to try to find films, streamed or DVD, that have both English and Spanish audio tracks, allowing me to alternate between the languages. And this is harder than I first imagined. Some films in dubbing is a distraction. I have found Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse in both languages, but not Into the Spider-Verse. Can you recommend any films good enough for multiple viewings that have both English and Spanish audio, but also can you recommend Spanish films full stop that are suitable for multiple viewings? Big question. I mean, one you mentioned last week, actually, and Mark mentioned when he was talking about Vanilla Sky, was the original of that.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Open Your Eyes. I mean, if you want a good starter Spanish movie, Open Your Eyes is well worth checking out with Penelope Cruz.
Yeah, I kind of worry that my answer to this question is just listing good Spanish films, because yes. I know nothing about alternative audio tracks. I would say, goodness, Almodovar, of course, just plough through that filmography to start with. Buñuel, obviously, Los Olvidados, Viridiana. I mean, goodness, he's made loads of good ones. Del Toro Spanish films.
Oh, yeah.
Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth. Yeah. But look, there was one that was, I think, quite overlooked last year called Official Competition, which was this Spanish comedy directed by Mariano Cohn and Gaston Duprat. And it starred Penelope Cruz as this eccentric Almodovar-like filmmaker, and Antonio Banderas and Oscar Martinez as the two leading men in her latest project. Now, it was a lockdown film, so it was shot, most of the film is them rehearsing together and squabbling together. It's this extremely funny clash of egos comedy. Banderas' character is not a million miles from the real Banderas, and he kind of sends himself up very gamely in this. But more broadly, it's just very funny about the top of the European art house food chain. You know, what actually motivates these people? Is it always art and integrity and, you know, bearing their soul on screen, or are there other things afoot? So yes, official competition, definitely. Almodovar himself, obviously. I mean, those films are just delicious. I find when I'm watching Almodovar, I kind of think, nobody makes films as good. And if you're talking, this is as good as it gets.
Absolutely. And if you're talking about multiple viewings, which Chris was, I mean, absolutely, those films, the rewards you get from multiple viewings. Sophie wants to probe deep and psychologically. She says, do you think directors have the best and most interesting dreams? I don't know how we're going to answer this. Just imagine the tracking shots. On that note, have you ever had a bodacious dream that filled you with pride upon waking up thinking, wow, that would make a great film? Talk about high production values. I was always told that talking about your dreams to other people is sort of one of the worst things that you can do because it's ultimately incredibly boring to other people.
Do you know what I dreamt about last night?
Go on.
Waiting in a queue for a cafe for 3 hours. And it was mysteriously, when every table was vacated, someone else would materialize and fill it before I could have a chance to get... That's boring, you know. I'd like to see David Lynch's dreams. In fact, maybe yes. I do see David Lynch's dreams in David Lynch's films. His films are... You know, people talk about dreamlike films. His are the ones that actually do feel like dreams, not just... weird or surreal, but like strange things spidery creeping around in your psyche.
I find increasingly my dreams are very tense and involve me waking up in a cold sweat. I think M. Night Shyamalan writes and directs my dreams currently. They're not very comfortable. I think we're getting onto a different topic altogether now.
But he's on a strong streak at the moment, so that's
yes,
good.
Yes, no, absolutely. This is good M. Night Shyamalan, my dreams, not the bad patch. Ewan in Norwich says, dear Aphex Twin and Richard D. James, one of the highlights of every cinema trip for me is the brilliant trailer of Digital Cinema Media and its banging soundtrack. Two questions. Did they have to make it slap that hard? And what does Digital Cinema Media do? That means they get to run ads before every film that I watch. I mean, I'm tempted to refer back to a question from earlier from Benjamin, where he says, look it up. But can't answer this.
The answer is, yes, it did have to slap that hard because DCM's ad is so good because they're an ad company. I mean, they supply the adverts to UK cinema chains. They used to be part of the Rank Foundation,
they did Rank,
I think.
Screen advertising.
Yes, right. Yeah. So they've grown out of this tradition of British advertising in cinemas. But yes, the ad is good because this is their business.
Pearl and Dean were another one, of course. Everybody knows them, don't they?
I'm not going to embarrass myself, but yes.
But they are another of the advertising companies. Stephen Cork says, dear Heretic and Dominion, do either of you buy into the notion that a film can be ruined by sequels, prequels, reboots, spin-offs, or requels? In general, I don't buy into this. Terminator 2 Judgment Day is still arguably the greatest action sci-fi ever, which Robbie studied for film studies at A-level, despite the poorly executed retconning shenanigans of its follow-ups. That said, I am inclined to think that Toy Story 4 has forever changed how I experienced Toy Story 3, which has one of the greatest endings ever, but one that I can't help but feel is diluted by the existence of the fourth entry. Given Mark's notorious feelings about Exorcist 2, The Heretic, I'm guessing it's not something that he buys into, but I'm curious about both of your takes on this. Stephen Cork.
Yeah, so I think the only logical response to this is it shouldn't, because the old film still exists. I mean, providing the old film still exists in its original form and has not been messed around with in order to, you know, smooth over series continuity. But I do get it. Now, Jurassic Park was this incredibly special film to me growing up. And I think the shine has come off Jurassic Park to an extent because of the sequelizing of the thing and the, you know, the last two and the last one particularly I just thought were absolutely dismal. But then Back to the Future was also a very important film to me growing up. There have been no extra Back to the Futures, and the shine is still very much on that. That said, I'm going to take the boys to see Jurassic Park when it does its 35th anniversary re-release. And I'm sure reconnecting with the original film should hopefully dispel that stuff. I mean, look, the example I always go back to this with is Ghostbusters. And it's not because of a subsequent film, but because of the way in which a section of the original film's fan base reacted to it. So when the all-women Ghostbusters came out, it was met with so much toxicity from people who kind of held themselves up as being, you know, great champions of the original film. I now can't watch the original without thinking, God, a lot of bozos love this, don't they? And that's sad because the film is good, but there is that kind of cloud hanging over it now. But then that's kind of outside the actual films that were made. This is more of a cultural conversation thing. So yeah, I do get it, you know, that things, you can sour towards things because of no, even though the film itself hasn't changed.
Yeah, but I guess as long as the originals, like you said, are still there, and surely now more than ever, they're available to watch relatively easily, as long as they are still out there and they still exist in the form that we originally saw them in, then they're not going to go away. It's just whether they get slightly overshadowed, I guess, isn't it, by the newer ones. Thank you for that, Steve. And Joan in Akron says, what is the most quotable film of all time? I mean, in a way, the easy answer is to say, well, the biggest films of all time are the ones that most people will have seen. And so if you say King of the World or whatever, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, they're the ones that people are going to know. Personally, I would go for, and it's got to be a cult film, isn't it? That's sort of where the quoting really comes in, like Rocky Horror Picture Show, when people shout out the lines from the film when they're watching the movie. Or Big Lebowski. I mean, Big Lebowski is full of, you know, The Dude Abides and That Rug Really Tied the Room Together and all those kind of things. So I'd probably side on the Big Lebowski.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is Spinal Tap, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Of course, any films, yeah, that contain extended comic riffs that people love, yeah, performing to their friends in the pub, to you know, to everyone's unabashed delight. You know, obviously those are going to be big plays. Yeah, I think objectively the most correct answer is probably Casablanca, because it's a film that people have seen so many times, and it has that great screenwriting, but it also has that expansive fan base where, you know, whenever it's been on TV at Christmas or any other time, you just have those lines drilled into your head. And yeah, that is, it's absolutely true that sometimes people do get those lines wrong just because they're so kind of over familiar with them. Play It Sam, of course, famously rendered as Play It Again Sam, which he never says in the film. But yeah, I mean, in terms of great writing, I recently watched Murder, My Sweet, which is the first Philip Marlowe detective film starring Dick Powell. Every single line in that screenplay is quotable. I mean, there's one point he describes a female witness as a charming middle-aged lady with a face like a bucket of mud. I mean, it's just every single line is this incredibly, you know, machine-tooled zinger. But because it's not as looming in the cultural conversation as Casablanca is, it's just never, ever going to match Play It Sam or, you know, Start a Beautiful Friendship, all this stuff that's just out there that we know so well from Casablanca.
Those are the questions. On to the schmestions. This is from, let me just check, Maggie in Doncaster, who says, Simon and Mark, having seen Barack Obama's Sound of Summer Instagram post, where he lists 10 songs he recommends, some old, some new, I wondered if you had a similar post and what would it look like? In the interest of brevity, instead of 10, maybe you could recommend 3 to 5, with the songs being either new for 2023 or ones you've discovered in 2023. In the spirit of sharing, I would recommend Blur the Narcissist, Lisa O'Neill, All the Tired Horses, and Fairlies by Grind Chatton. Please consider watching Arcane on Netflix, she also says, so that you can see a video game adaptation that is good. Good video game adaptations aren't just limited to The Last of Us. 3 Barack Obama-style recommendations, Robbie.
Individual tracks.
It's, I mean, I've got albums, but you,
yeah,
know.
Yeah, no, I'm more of an album person. I mean, what have I listened to recently? So let's start here. Lil Yachty.
Oh,
great,
right,
album.
Yeah.
IRL by Mahalia. It's really good. And the Janelle Monáe album is really good. Yeah, in terms of individual songs, though, I mean, I hear stuff on algorithmically generated, you know, exercise workout playlists, and it's all rubbish. I mean, that one about Jesus going for a night out in a nightclub or whatever it,
yes,
is, like, and it's that kind of music that motivates you to, you know, keep exercising, is not good music. Those are the individual tracks I listen to, but albums, you know, I can do, but singles, no.
I'd include that Janelle Monáe album as well. I think that's wonderful. Great summer album. Jessie Ware, I put in there. That feels good. Alison Goldfrapp, The Love Inventions. I essentially like female vocalists and house, disco, R&B beats. And every year when I do a sort of December, what have I been listening to? I'm shocked at the lack of male singers or bands involved. It is pretty much exclusively female singers and female singer-songwriters.
How are you on Wet Leg?
Like Wet Leg?
Yeah.
Yes, like Wet Leg a lot. Yeah, they're on my list last year. This is from Maggie in Doncaster. As we've got renowned Keanu East, James King, on the show, I'd like to know his top five Keanu films and his top five acting performances. These do not have to be the same lists. I mean, we've mentioned Point Break already, and I think any top five Keanu list has to include that. I would put in The Matrix. I would put in Excellent Adventure. I would put in John Wick 3, Parabellum.
Interesting, not
yeah.
4.
I love 4. I think it's, well, I don't know it as well. It's newer. I haven't watched it as many times. I just think the Halle Berry stuff, the dog stuff in Parabellum is wonderful. And I'd put in My Own Private Idaho as well in terms of my favorite films of his. I mean, in performances, most of those, but also Something's Gotta Give. I love him in Dr. Mercer in Something's Gotta Give, which is just really sort of relaxed and gentle, normal performance from Keanu, everyday guy kind of performance. Wonderful chemistry with Diane Keaton as well. I think Nancy Myers really gets the best out of both of them. And then he's done some great cameos, often as himself in SpongeBob. Always Be My Maybe is a wonderful cameo, really, from Keanu Reeves, playing Keanu Reeves, sending himself up. Even Duke Kaboom in Toy Story 4 is sort of sending himself up. So a long list of some of my favorites there for Maggie and Doncaster. Do you have a favorite?
It's Point Break. I mean, you can't escape Point Break. I think that film is just, it's kind of important in changing how we think about men on screen is can't be overstated.
This one's for you, Robbie. This is Karina in Sheffield. Robbie, why do you have a beard? which is quite trim today, actually. Have you trimmed it?
Yeah. So interestingly, I don't really have a beard anymore. No. I mean, I've sort of the remains of a beard. Why do I have a beard?
And there's more.
Okay, go on.
Yeah. Have you always had one? Do you experiment with its shape and length?
Well clearly the answer is yes, I do.
And would you ever consider non-beard life?
Yes. And just to be clear, we're talking about beard and the facial hair sense here. Right. Okay, fine. I grew a beard in my mid-20s because then in those days I had the jawline of a 12-year-old and needed to obviously disguise that and look older. But now, I'm kind of shaving it off. I mean, I'm sure you can appreciate this. I'm told constantly that I look like Henry Cavill. And basically, it's just by my mum. But I thought, you know, the ultimate facial hair recently in cinema is Cavill in Mission Impossible Fallout.
The tash.
The big tash and the kind of three-day scruff.
Yeah.
So I thought now that I'm early 40s, I can do the jawline is now kind of aged up. So it's bearable now. So maybe I can go for the big kind of nasty threatening moustache and the scruff and just kind of lean into the Cavill likeness even more.
So that's where we are now.
We're not at Cavill yet, but we're on the way.
Cavill.
Yep.
Destination Cavill. And final question comes from Jules in Peckham. Do either of you believe in ghosts? If not, have you ever had a what the bleep was that then moment?
Yes, so I have a story to tell about this. Do you have one?
Only in that thinking about it, I was I don't believe in ghosts and I don't have a what the bleep moment. So in cinematic terms, in film narrative terms, I am now a prime candidate to exactly have one of those moments. I am the person in the film who goes, none of this is real, you know, it's all nonsense. And then, of course, gets haunted and gets troubled by supernatural beings.
And that'll teach you.
Exactly. Yeah. So I feel that in saying this, I'm setting myself up. But that's my answer.
Yes. So, yes, look, I agree. Ghosts objectively don't exist. But there was this really strange occurrence when I was a kid that I've never quite been able to get my head around. So I used to share a bedroom with my younger brother, who, funnily enough, this week has moved to Vietnam. Nothing to do with sharing a bedroom with me, I hasten to add. But yes, so we had bunk beds, and I, being the older brother, slept on the top, and he, being the younger, slept on the bottom.
Yeah.
And then we got to that age, I think I must have been about 8, he was 6, and the time came to move to separate bedrooms, and so he went through into his room, and I stayed in the old room, and I continued to sleep in these bunk beds. So I was up on the top bunk and the bottom bunk was empty, but for whatever reason it remained made up as a bed, so there was this empty bunk underneath. Now every so often during the night I would wake up to the sound of rustling sheets, And at first, I thought it was me moving in bed. But then I would lie still, and it was like the rustling was coming from the unslept-in bunk below. And I suppose it was something that I would have put down to just imagination, but it happened a number of times. And this was, you know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning when, you know, the house was completely quiet. Nobody was up. Total darkness. And this kind of noise of like a fitful sleeper turning over. And one, in that way that kids do, one night I heard this noise again and decided I was going to be brave, you know, heart absolutely beating against my ribcage, and said out loud the word ghost. Okay. And what happened, I swear I heard under from the bed underneath a new sound, the sound of someone sitting up, bolt upright in bed. And I was so enormously freaked out by this. I, you know, didn't attempt anything like this. But we grew up in quite a religious household, Christian Church of Scotland. And I sort of as this like kind of protective talisman. I thought, okay, so I need to sleep with a Bible now. And, you know, to kind of ward off evil. And I had this christening Bible, which had this cardboard but leather effect cover. And, you know, gilded pages down the edges. And this seemed like, you know, it was, if you were going to use a Bible, this was going to be a powerful Bible to use. So this Bible I slid under my pillow, and I thought, if with this thing here, I'll be fine. And then I think, I don't know, it, maybe like a week later or so, this noise of the turning over woke me up in the middle of the night again. And I put my hand under the pillow to reach for the Bible, and there was nothing there. And while I was kind of turning to reach for it, my right toe brushed against something in the bottom of the bed. And it was, you know, it was rectangular and had a bit of give to it. And it was clearly the Bible had made its way down to the bottom of the bed somehow. And so kind of curling up and swiveling over, reaching down under the covers to retrieve this, my hand got to where my toe had been, and I put my hand out to touch the cover of this Bible, and it came to rest on something cold and smooth that felt like another hand. And this moved away and then came down to touch, and then, you know, I kind of got the Bible, and I held this thing so tightly, still to this day, in fact, there are like crescent moon impressions where my nails, you know, at 8 years old, were kind of clutching into this thing, held against my chest for the rest of the night. And that was, you know, that was the last thing that happened. And, the, you know, who knows what it was, you know, but, and as I say, ghosts objectively do not exist. There's no such thing.
That's absolutely terrifying. this is like, we're about to end, right? We're about to end part three. This is the final thing we're going to talk about. This is the end. We're going to end on that terrifying note.
I can tell you, I've never slept in a bunk bed since. When I moved into a floor level bed, that was as high as I slept for the rest, you know, ever since. But yes.
And did you ever talk to your brother about this?
You mean, I think it was him sneaking through and...
Well, possibly, but also it was someone in his place, wasn't it? It was a thing in his place where he had been.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky to raise this stuff with family members. I mean, particularly, you know, bearing in mind we were church-attending Christians, you know, you don't want to get too deep into creepy stuff. So no, I've not. I mean, I've told the story a few times, but it's...
That's absolutely... What a macabre note to end on.
I feel like I should do a mwahaha or something like that. But yes, no, ghosts don't exist.
No,
but
no, just of course
weird,
not.
But sometimes weird things happen.
Robert, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. This has been Take 3. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon.